All right, welcome back, everyone, to the Badgerland Birding Podcast, bringing you birding news and stories from the Badger State and beyond. Today, we're talking with Brooke Poplin, a master's student at the University of North Texas, about some of the cool research she's been doing. Her lost her voice a little bit, doing some cool bird stuff out there, but we're excited to hear what she has to say today.
Hi, thanks y'all so much for having me. Yeah, I lost my voice birding at High Island this past weekend.
Oh, wait, there's a dog in the back.
There's a
It's a
dog in the back.
rule that you always have to showcase your animals if they
All
make it out
right.
on the screen.
Axel, give me a big. Come here.
That's a happy dog right there.
Oh yeah,
This
that tail is
is
wagging.
Axel.
Aw.
He's a Dogo Argentino and he's my son.
Adorable. Yeah, that's a rule we have because almost every podcast so far, an animal's wandered into the screen. So we're just like, you have to showcase your pet if it's gonna end up on screen. So.
That's a good rule.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about the work you're doing now and how you ended up getting into that.
So I am currently a biologist, raptor biologist, and I study the social behavior of Harris's hawks, and I work in the Rio Grande Valley of South Texas. I guess the way that I got into this particular project, in my undergrad, I started off as a veterinary science major. Birds were not on my radar. I don't have a typical, I'm obsessed with birds now, but typically I think a lot of people that I meet that do the work that I do, they grew up going birding with their parents or camping with their parents. Like I said, birds weren't on really my radar. And I had an advisor, or professor, Dr. Jim Bednarz, who's now my advisor for graduate school. And he kind of saw potential in me as a research assistant, and he invited me to come work at our local bird banding station. So I got to experience songbird banding for the first time. And doing that, I got involved with our UNT is a school I go to, the University of North Texas. We have a American Kestrel research project and a painted bunting research project, in addition to my Harris's hawk research project. And these have both been ongoing for both about 7 or 8 years now. So I participated in both of those projects and became very quickly sold on birds and birding and all of the different avenues that that had to offer a young ecologist. Of course, I changed my major to ecology, and I knew that I wanted to work with birds for the rest of my life. And through working with those projects, Dr. Bednarz, he pulled me aside one day and he said, "Hey, I think you'd be good working with larger raptors than American kestrels. We're going on a trip that I'm taking my graduate students to band red-tailed hawks if you'd like to come." And as soon as he said that, I kind of thought, "That's what I want to do. That's I want to go on, I have to go on that trip." So of course, over the next few months, I begged and begged and begged him. I was able to tag along. And from the minute that they banded a red-tailed hawk in front of me, I was in awe, and they let me release that hawk. And when they put her into my hands, I just knew. I was like, "All right, I'm sold on raptors, large raptors specifically." And so I continued working with red-tailed hawks through my undergrad. That was I continued bird banding and volunteering on the other projects, but my main focus was raptors. And I completed an undergraduate research project on the foraging behavior of American kestrels. And in doing that, I sat and watched kestrels for many, many, many hours and watched what they did and recorded it. And then I did my own analysis on that data. And I realized that I really like studying behavior. I was fascinated by raptor behavior, bird behavior, et cetera. And of course, the Harris's Hawk Project at UNT was active, but I didn't know a lot about it because it wasn't a local project like the other projects I was involved in. It, of course, requires travel from North Texas, where the school is, down to the valley. So I heard that Dr. Bednarz was hiring, and I was graduating with my from my undergrad, and I told him, I said, this is what I want to do. I want to continue studying raptors with you, and I want to study their social behavior." And that was kind of what the project that he designed entailed. And here I am now. And right now I'm in my second year of my master's. And I am on track to graduate next year, so I will have completed in 3 years, and I'm having the best time.
So what are some things that you've discovered about social behavior in raptors, particularly Harris's hawks, which are kind of known for working in groups sometimes to hunt even? Is there anything you found that's really surprised you or that's been a big discovery?
Yes, so the Harris's hawks population in South Texas is really odd. They're real weird. And I haven't published anything about this yet, but my project kind of came to be for background. Like Ryan said, the Harris's hawks are cooperative hunters. So they hunt kind of like a wolf pack. Their nickname is the Wolves of the Sky. It's been reported that they've hunted in groups of up to 10 individuals to pursue prey items that are larger than they are, and one hawk couldn't bring down by itself safely. And sometimes it's not just large prey, but it's also prey that's very agile, like small songbirds. Essentially, this is a strategy that allows them to access a more diverse range of prey. And this is beneficial to them because they live in the desert and sometimes droughts, what have you. Prey can be hard to come by. So being able to cooperatively hunt black-tailed jackrabbits and cottontail rabbits is super beneficial. And so this was the work that Dr. Bednarz actually did for his PhD and postdoc projects, is he studied the cooperative hunting behavior of the New Mexico population of Harris's hawks in depth. And he was the first to kind of publish that. And he said, because of the benefits that these hawks are getting by cooperative hunting, this must be the driver for their social behavior. So this must be why they're forming and living in cooperative groups, is so that they can easily kind of join up and perform these cooperative hunts. And then they share the prey for days. If five hawks bring down one black-tailed jackrabbit, they can eat that for 3 or 4 days at a time. They don't have to hunt again. And again, that's really beneficial when you're living in a harsh environment. So that was accepted for a really long time. In addition to that, it was also accepted for a really long time that the Harris's hawks in South Texas were not social, that they didn't form social groups. They were strictly kind of monogamous, maybe a third member of the group every so often. In 2015, Bill Clark, one of my collaborators, he's a raptor biologist and fanatic that lives in the valley. He had observed the Harris's hawks in South Texas forming groups and behaving cooperatively, essentially. And so he published a paper that actually said the average group size of the Harris's hawks was 2.58 birds. And 56% of all of the groups that he observed were three or more individuals. So essentially he said the population's highly social. I don't know what y'all are talking about, saying that they're strictly monogamous. And Dr. Bednar saw this and decided to start our research in the valley. And in 2022, Sam Hagler published, Sam Hagler was a student from Cornell University that volunteered on our project to do some undergraduate research. And she decided for her project, she was going to look at the diet of the Harris's hawks by putting up nest cameras. So her hypothesis, based on the cooperative hunting behavior that you would expect, was that you would primarily be seeing them eat large prey items, like rabbits. But that was not what they found. 0.7% of all prey deliveries were rabbits. And it's important to note that these were juvenile rabbits that Dr. Bednarz felt that the hawks could take down by themselves. So cooperative hunting wasn't necessary. As for the rest of what they were eating, it was hispid cotton rats and small birds. Again, things that hawks catch solitarily all the time. So this is kind of where my project started, is, all right, well, if they're not cooperative hunting to get large prey items, are they cooperative hunting? And what strategies are they using? And B, if the driving factor of their sociality isn't this cooperative hunting, what might it be? Is there something else that we're missing here with why these groups are beneficial to the hawks? I'm assuming I'll talk a little bit more about my methodology later, but I have watched these hawks for over 150 hours at this point. I think it's a little closer to 200 at this point. And I have only seen them cooperative hunting three times. So they don't cooperative hunt in South Texas. And that's kind of a big exclamation point of what I've found so far. The cooperative hunts that I have observed, the three, only one of those three was from a group of hawks. There was four hawks. The other two was just a pair. And all three times, it was the hawks were gathered around a little shrub or a burrow, and they would kind of take turns pouncing on the burrow, waiting for the rabbit or the rat to come out, and then the other hawks would be waiting there to ambush it. So this was called the flush and ambush method. In New Mexico, the most often way that Dr. Bednarz observed them cooperatively hunting was by chasing these rabbits through the sky and taking turns dive bombing it and, you know, running it, being super strategic and just running it till it's so tired or it trips or it gets hurt. And it was really dramatic. And they actually had to follow the hawks in their cars to be able to get any kind of data. The three cooperative hunts that I've observed are not dramatic at all. One of those three, by the pair, they kind of took turns pouncing on the shrub for 45 minutes or so, and then they kind of were just like, all right, we're done, and gave up, and they never actually got the prey. So clearly, you know, they weren't super hungry at that time or anything. So not nearly as dramatic as what was observed in New Mexico. So there's a really big behavioral difference there as well. And I am continuing to watch the hawks, and hopefully after I analyze my data, I'll be able to come up with some more concrete hypotheses as to why their sociality is beneficial to them. Right now, our leading hypothesis is that it allows them to exploit their preferred habitat, which is really interesting because they like to dwell in very thick thorn scrub vegetation. So typically, if you've ever been to the Rio Grande Valley or in the New Mexico, I don't know off the top of my head the specific areas of New Mexico where Harris's hawks like to be, but the vegetation is super duper thick, super duper thorny. Mesquite trees, yuccas, aloes, cacti, vegetation that wants to hurt you. And you don't find any other hawks exploiting this this type of land cover, just the Harris's hawks, and they're really good at it. So one of our hypotheses is that their social behavior allows them to actually do this, to be able to hunt in these really thick areas, better protect their territory, defend their territory, and raise chicks. And one of the ways I'm looking at this to see if this hypothesis is holding up is by comparing their sociality from between urban habitats. So we've got urbanization of Harris's hawks happening in the valley, and Harris's hawks that live in really natural areas like Laguna Atascosa National Wildlife Refuge. And one really interesting thing that I found so far that I'm really excited about is the group size in urban areas or in developed areas is significantly lower than it is in the natural areas. So the birds that are living in these really harsh environments have significantly more group members than the ones living in the not so harsh environments, where there's more kind of prey available and you can see the ground, etc. So that was another really cool thing that I actually was kind of just playing with the data one day, and I saw this trend and I was like, oh, and kind of ran with it. And right now I'm working on a paper for publication on that. So hopefully when I start analyzing the behavioral data, we'll find some more kind of differences between the hawks that live in the natural areas and the urban areas, and kind of see what those benefits might be to sociality.
Yeah, that's really interesting. With spending so much time with one species, how well do you feel like you know all their little behaviors? Like, can you see a Harris's hawk and just be like, oh, that one's going to hunt in like a minute? Or like, do you feel like you really have this connection with, that one, he's having a rough day. Like, how well do you feel like you know this species, and what do you think the benefit is of spending so much time looking at one bird? Because I feel like all the researchers I talk to that have their species that they follow, they just know it so well and they have this connection with it.
I 100% feel like I know these Harris's hawks so well. I can confidently say I know these Harris's hawks better than anyone else in the world because I've spent so many hours with them. And I can look at a hawk and say, all right, they're about to switch perches or they're about to move or something, just based on the way they're standing, the way they're interacting with other hawks, or even sometimes if they're just looking at the ground. And I think it's really beneficial, and it's really a privilege to be able to get to know your study species as well, by being able to do these behavioral observations, and kind of be able to anticipate their movements and get to know them. A lot of research that people do on any type of wildlife, they don't get to be super intimate with their study species like I do. And that helps, I think that definitely helps me appreciate them more. And another thing I find is that when I work with other people, whether that's my technicians or visitors or anything, they hear me talking about the hawks and how well, I kind of know them, and I think that helps them connect with the hawks better as well. Anyone that knows me knows that I'm obsessed with Harris's hawks, and if that wasn't already abundantly clear. So that's another joy of my job, is getting to share what I know about these birds.
Do you know them on an individual level? Or like, have you given them names like, oh, it's James, or like that's, or maybe they have more banded names like N9 or something like that? But do you
I like
kind of
the
know
human
each
names.
individual one?
Some of them do. So we have over 600 birds banded now.
Wow.
And so there are some birds that I see all the time, and they don't necessarily have human names, but one of my favorite birds in my study area is 7/6. And 7/6 should have a human name, but at this point, I think he's just 7/6. That's his name. And I always see him on the same power pole every day. No questions asked. He just sits on the power pole and he hunts there and he hangs out with his mate, and it's great. A lot of them I just called by their band names. But some of them, the ones that I use VHF telemetry for my project, so some of my birds get trackers, and so the tracker birds sometimes I do name because I'm a little bit more intimate with them. The first Harris hawk that I ever banded, I also was the first hawk I ever put a transmitter on. Her band combination was 9/5, so I named her Dolly because she's working 9 to 5.
That's a good one.
Has it gotten to the point yet where you're telling your friends and family about the Hawks as if they're your other friends and family? Like, yeah, 7/6 today. Dude was having a meltdown.
Yeah, I do. Well, so my technicians, they know my birds' names. And so sometimes I'll casually be like, ah, Willow was acting a fool earlier,
As
oh
she
my God,
would.
she oh my God, Stormy caught a dove today, and it was really cool. Yeah, I do that stuff all the time. But
So I want to go back to first of all, Wolves of the Sky is the coolest nickname for any bird that I've ever heard. Second, is it all raptors for you, or is it specifically, do you, I know you love Harris's hawks, of course, because you've gotten to know them so well, but do you just have a passion for all birds of prey versus all regular birds?
Yeah, I do have a specific fascination with all birds of prey. Any raptors. I love vultures. I love caracaras. I love, obviously hawks and falcons. I love other birds too, but I'm just,
I don't know. You don't sound like
yeah,
it.
I'm not buying
Yeah,
it.
you're
She's
like, yeah,
like,
I
oh,
love
I
other
love them
birds too.
too.
You
I
celebrated
do.
when your hawk caught a dove. So, I mean, it doesn't seem like you really like other birds that much.
Well, I want my hawks to eat. but no, I love working at the bird banding station and birding, but I'm the raptor girl. That's what I'm known as. I'm obsessed with raptors, period. And I'm obsessed with hawks more than anything.
Did you get to work a lot with the Kestrel project then? Because you said that's kind of what you started on. I wanted to know, where are they at as a species right now in terms of conservation? Because I remember a number of years ago we went to a kind of little symposium about them, and they were talking about how they're in severe decline. Is that still the case? Have they rebounded at all? What's their status?
So they are still in severe decline, and we still don't know why. So a big question mark with that is, A big gray area in American kestrel research is what they do during their wintering season, as well as their migration. So we have a big wintering population of American kestrels here in North Texas, and that's what our project is focused on. So right now, the current graduate student, Brooke Prater, she is going to be the first researcher to gather data on American kestrel wintering home ranges. We've already published some research on their pairing behavior in the winter, and we've completed some research on their survival in the winter, although I don't think any of it has been submitted for publication yet. It will be in the future. We're also looking at difference between resident American kestrels versus migratory American kestrels to hopefully answer some questions about the migratory birds. We don't have a huge resident population, but we have enough to be able to start to hopefully do some kind of data analysis on that. And hopefully that'll help us kind of put the puzzle pieces together on why these birds are declining. A big hypothesis and something that's really interesting that we're finding is the American kestrels are roosting in man-made structures quite a bit, and instead of natural cavities, as they are quote unquote supposed to. And this might be an ecological trap for the kestrels, is these, they're nesting in transmission poles, then they have little holes in them, perfect for kestrels. And that in turn brings them closer to collisions with cars and electrocution. So this is another thing that our current graduate student is researching, is their roost sites and how often they're roosting in man-made structures. And she's finding that more often than not, they are roosting in man-made structures. So of course, we don't want the kestrels to be in decline, but we want to help figure out why. I'm still very involved in that project. I have a huge passion for our kestrel population here in North Texas.
Yeah, that's awesome. They're a really cool species. They're one of the ones that you see and you think it's cool, kind of regardless of how into birds you are, I think.
Right.
Yeah, you mentioned your capture method. So obviously, you've got a bunch of banded birds. You've done the transmitters. Just kind of going through banding methods, I don't know if any of them would catch a raptor real well. How do you guys go about catching those Harris's hogs?
Yeah, so we use Balchatry traps, Balchatry. So if you Google it, a picture will pop up. And basically, these look like little cages. Usually they're kind of dome shaped. They look about like that. And they're made of hardware cloth. So there's tiny little holes in them, and we put mice in them, and the mice run around in the little cage, essentially. On the outside of the cage, we attach slip knots or nooses made of fishing line, and this is all around the trap. And so the hawk will see the mouse or the sparrow or the dove, whatever you know you want to put in the trap, house sparrows and Eurasian collared doves specifically, whatever you want to put in the trap to catch the hawks. And they will come down with their talons, and sometimes they'll kind of stand on the side of it and look at it a little bit. Eventually, they're going to jump on top of the trap. They're going to try to dance a little bit to get the lure animal, and then their toes are going to get caught in those fishing lines, and then they're going to be stuck to the trap. So the lure animal, 99 times out of 100 is completely safe. Sometimes we have, you know, a kestrel get a little scratch on the top of their head, but for the most part, they're completely safe. And the hawks are completely safe because they're stuck to the trap. We make sure we weigh them down. And then we are usually nearby, not too far away, watching out of a car, ready as soon as the hawk is stuck to the trap to kind of zoom up to the trap with the car and get the hawk and get it off, get it banded as soon as possible and released. So they're pretty cool.
Wild.
It does sound wild. I do have to know, how many times have you taken a beak or a talon to the hand?
I've been lucky, actually. I have not been severely harmed by a raptor. You have to be really careful around them. But how many times? Probably, at this point, probably 40 or 50 times. Harris's hawks are they'll bite you more than they'll try to get you with their talons. Red-tailed are kind of the opposite, but I've got a pretty gnarly scar. You probably won't be able to see it in the camera. Which knuckle is it on? One of my knuckles. Where a harris's hawk bit me back in March, and I think it's gonna turn into a scar, so I'm excited about that. But sorry. But yeah, no, I've definitely seen, my technicians sometimes I have to tell them to be careful, and they're not careful, and accidents have happened. So anytime you're working with wildlife, you have to watch what they do, especially with raptors.
Yeah, and
Your
it's
techs just
important.
come back missing a finger. You're like, I told you to be careful.
It's important to know you guys have all, the permits and everything to do this. Random people obviously shouldn't be going out trying to do it and stuff like
Put the
that.
disclaimer on it. Don't try this at
You
home.
got to, because someone's gonna be out there like, I heard that podcast. I wanted to go catch a hawk.
Yes, you are not allowed to touch any native bird species without the proper permitting, and we are all trained to do so, and we have the proper permitting, so do not handle wildlife. Yeah, on all of banding posts now, we are actually required to put a disclaimer by the bird banding lab so that people don't see that and just decide, oh, cool, this is how you catch a hawk? I'm gonna go get one. No,
Right.
don't do
Yeah.
that.
I know that's kind of been a big point of emphasis with banders too. And I think from like a general public perspective, people don't really understand the benefit of it as much as they just see a bird in the hand and they're like, let it go. It's not supposed to be in the hand. Can you tell us a little bit about all the benefits of bird banding that you guys have found in your research?
So first of all, bird banding allows for identification of the birds, and that is huge for many reasons. Particularly with research, it allows us to make conclusions that we couldn't make if the birds were not banded. For example, with the harris's hawks, if I have a group of four harris's hawks and I only ever see two of them at a time and all four of them aren't banded, I cannot say in any kind of research that I publish that there are four harris's hawks. But if two of them have a band on their legs and two of them don't, then I can say I know for a fact that there are four harris's hawks, because one day I saw two that didn't have bands, and then another day I saw two that did have bands. So things like that are really important to allow for research to be properly communicated. Specifically with bird banding with passerines, you can't really recapture raptors, but for passerines, bird banding allows for you can follow the bird's migratory paths with recapturing. You can also see how often they're returning to a certain site with recapturing. All of that data is super duper duper important for conservation, especially with the way that the land is being developed so rapidly.
I
Now
was
it's not.
gonna ask, with the raptors, you said you can't recapture them. Is it simply because they're too smart compared to passerines?
Yeah, they won't. Passerines, you just catch them in a mist net. So if they're hopping from tree to tree, they will collide with the mist net and they'll get caught. It's just pretty easy to recapture them. With the raptors, you have to put the trap down in front of them and they have to make the decision to go down. If they have made the decision in the past and they ended up being trapped, they won't get trapped and banded and processed. I think it's probably something akin to being abducted by aliens. They're not going to do that again. We've recaught harris's hawks a few times. We recaptured American kestrels a little bit more often than that. But yeah, no, for the, it's a general rule, once you catch a raptor, you're not going to be able to catch it again. So when you catch it, you want to make sure that you take all the measurements that you can, and you want to make sure that you band it. Well, you always want to make sure that you band it. But yeah, generally, there's a rule you're not going to be able to have that bird in hand ever again. So we always take that as law.
I think we should probably ask this too, because a lot of people don't know. Does banding at all hurt the bird or impact the bird's well-being in its regular survival?
Handling any wildlife comes with risks. And so, no, this doesn't hurt the birds. However, so for the raptors specifically, we've never had a raptor get injured on any of our projects. These raptors are very, very hardy. They're very durable, and we handle them as little time as we possibly can while accomplishing as much as possible. Our handling time for the hawks is down to about 10 minutes per hawk if we're not putting a transmitter on it. And then our kestrel time is about 7 or 8 minutes if we're not putting a transmitter on them. With the songbirds, however, songbirds do get a little bit stressed. They can get really stressed, and this can be really, really bad for them if the conditions are not great for banding, as in it's too hot or it's too windy or there's a lot of people around and they're talking. So to do this, we always make sure that we're banding in the right and the best conditions possible for the birds. We always make sure that we are not baby talking the birds. We're not being too loud around them. When the birds are not being processed, they are put in these cloth bags that basically they're kind of like wrapped in a little pillow, and they're able to breathe, and this de-stresses the bird. So then once we take the bird out for banding, we put the band on it, we put as much, we take the measurements as fast as possible, and we release it to help decrease the probability of the bird getting stressed out. If the bird does start getting stressed out, we know we are trained in watching for the signs of this. And if that is the case, either there's always a master bander, so this person has banded thousands and thousands of birds if they are able to attain this status. And at that point, the master bander will make the decision to either release the bird or put the bird back in the cloth bag to allow it to, again, de-stress a little bit more before handling it further. So there are steps that we take to make sure that the birds are as safe as possible. The benefits of bird banding are so important, and you cannot accomplish the benefits that you get from bird banding, you cannot accomplish in any other method. Having the bird in hand is imperative for studying their evolution and for studying their populations and the way they're moving, et cetera, et cetera. So I believe that there are quite a few resources on the Bird Banding Lab's website about the ethicality of bird banding and all of the rules that we have in place and the steps that we take to make sure that the birds are as safe as possible.
Yeah, definitely. So before we kind of jumped on the podcast officially, you mentioned you had a cool announcement to make about some new research that you're doing.
Yeah, so my project just got approved to put Apple AirTags on our birds. And this is really exciting because these are Bluetooth trackers that were essentially invented to help people find their wallets and their keys. And we were able to put together a proposal that said if we are able to attach these to the Hawks, which I have developed my own very safe, very, very effective attachment method for the Hawks, then we would be able to collect location data for about $22 a pop versus remote location data for about $22 pop. Any other method that we can use to collect these remote locations can range from $500-ish dollars up to $4,000, depending on the species and the quality of the data. So this brings the cost way, way, way down. We've already done some field testing, and we're really excited because essentially if a Harris's hawk is wearing a AirTag and it comes within, I believe it's 30 meters of any Apple device, this will ping the device and it will send me a location to my phone and I can see where the Harris socks are. This is really exciting because to this point, no one has completed a home range analysis on a Harris's hawk, and no one has successfully documented the dispersal of a Harris's hawk from its natal area. So we don't know where they go when they fledge their nests. So we're hoping that this A will be super effective for collecting this data very, very cost efficiently, and we can hopefully put this on other wildlife to study them better without, you know, putting all of our project costs on the trackers, which is a huge issue. And we can learn more about Harris's hawks specifically. So I'm really, really excited to begin this project.
Did you say any Apple device? So even someone who, you know, knows nothing about birds, if they have an iPhone, it'll ping to you?
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, so yeah, they don't need to do anything. No one needs to do anything. They don't even know that they're pinging the device. As long as it is an iOS 7 or higher, if it's a MacBook, if it's an iPad, or if it's an iPhone, if a Harris's hawk with an AirTag is perched on a power line and someone with an iPhone drives by the hawk, then in theory, it should send me a location to my iPhone.
So like if Derek or I were driving under a Harris's hawk that had that, it would ping back to you?
Yep. And y'all would never know.
Dang.
Is there any way
I'd
we
like
can get
know.
An app for it so that we can know? So we're like, we want to keep track of those Harris's hogs just as much as you.
That would be funny if Apple made a special app that was like Find My Harris's Hawk, and you can try to, anytime you flew past it, would be like, I'm helping with research.
Yeah.
So we've piloted this on box turtles, and I know that there are some other researchers that are putting them out on coyotes and white-tailed deer, and they seem to be working really well. So we're hoping that if we can get a lot of this data collected and published by the end of the year, we can communicate with Apple and maybe make the have them make the Apple AirTag 2 a little bit more friendly for wildlife researching, and yeah, maybe a little bit smaller, maybe a little bit broaden the range of that it requires for pinging, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one of our kind of long-term goals.
That's really cool. I think it'd be really neat and a good move for Apple to like be on board with that. I don't know how much they will be, but it'd be really neat if they were like, you know, a collaborator and funded stuff.
They yeah, have the money.
So too. I hope so. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about you and birding. So you said before we started the podcast that you just took a trip to High Island with your students. How was that? Tell us more about it.
So High Island is on the Bolivar Peninsula in around Houston, Texas. And this area is about 25, I think, or 30 feet higher than the rest of the surrounding land. So this is a really, really popular migration hotspot. And during spring migration, this is one of the best places to bird in the entire United States. Birds are coming from South America up into North America. And so depending on the day that you're there, you can see completely different species than you saw a week before. And yeah, so every year, our ornithology class at UNT, we take a 3-day trip down there and we camp, we rough it a little bit, and we spend from 6 a.m. in the morning to dark, so 8:30 at night, we are out there and we're birding and we're going to all these different places to look for birds. So in total, we had a little bit of a slower year this year, and I think that was just because of the weather. I don't think it was anything, you know, anything with the birds specifically. Just we picked a bad day to come. But we saw 167 species. Typically, we see around 200, 210, but that was still amazing. So as a class, altogether, that was the number we got. So we went to High Island for 2 days. We spent some time birding the beaches in Galveston, in the Bolivar Flats. So we got to see a bunch of really, really cool shorebirds, which my students loved because we love terns in this house. And then we went to the Anahuac Ponds. And so we got to see some bitterns and some blackneck stilts, and lots and lots and lots of Scolopacidae sandpipers. So really fun trip.
What was the best bird you found on that trip, in your opinion?
So there was a silly little chestnut-collared longspur that was so lost. And he was on the side of one of the roads down there. So these birds are amazing to get in this area, especially, you know, at this time of year. And so, yeah, he was super lost. Some birder just happened to be driving down this road and saw him. And so then everybody who came to bird at High Island took a little bit of a detour. It wasn't too far away from the actual High Island site itself, but just cars and cars and cars were just lined up all down this random road. And this little chestnut-collared longspur, there was this little, probably 10 by 5 foot patch of mud. And he was just hopping around in there. And we sat and watched him for probably 30, 45 minutes from the vans. People wanted to get pictures of him and whatnot. And he's just hung out by the side of the road. So many times cars were coming from the other direction and we were like, oh my God, no, don't hit the bird. And yeah, he just was sitting there by the side of the road, just lost, probably just confused. So watching him was a treat. We love lost vagrants that are so confused. And he was probably one of my birds of the trip. The other one was, I saw an American oyster catcher for the first time, and they're not super uncommon, but I guess I just never had seen one before. And I loved him. He was real sweet. I'm just sitting on the beach with all the terns.
There's something about those oyster catchers when you see them for the first time. You're just like, that's really neat. I think it's that, you know, the crazy color on the eye and then the super plasticky looking orange bill is just very strange. Also, I think that longspur is trying to hitchhike. That's my personal
Yeah.
opinion. Other than Harris's hawks and kestrels, what is your favorite bird?
Well, my number one favorite bird is, believe it or not, a peregrine falcon.
More than Harris's hawks?
More than Harris's hawks. Harris's hawks are
Wow.
number two.
That's
So,
harsh. Surprising.
I have always been absolutely obsessed with peregrine falcons. Everything about them. I'm really, really interested in birds adapting to urban environments. So, of course, they're kind
And the
of the poster
speed.
child for that. Yeah, and the speed and their sexual dimorphism, and they're so freaking cute. Yeah, I love peregrine falcons. My favorite non-raptor is a Baltimore Oriole because they're beautiful.
Was that it? Just they're beautiful. I thought you were gonna keep going.
Yeah, they're beautiful. They're cool. I love Icteridae. I don't know. I don't really have another reason. I'm just fascinated
Hey,
by them.
that's okay. You don't have to have another reason. Since you're down in the valley so often, have you been getting all the rare stuff down there too? When you're observing the Harris's hawks, you just say, oh, I'm gonna take a little work break and go check out the fantail warbler.
Southern lapwing
Yeah, a little
action.
southern lapwing action.
I hope that I will get to go. I go back in 2 weeks, so I don't know if he'll still be there, but if he is, I'm gonna try to go see him. But no, I don't get a chance to do that very often. And it's sad because I always start my trips because I can only go down there on breaks from school. So I'm there winter break, spring break, and summer break. And I go down there and I'm like, all right, I'm gonna make time. There's been a roadside hawk there for the last few months. I don't know if he's still being sighted, but in Resaca de la Palma State Park, and I'm like, all right, I'm gonna take an afternoon and go find him, and then I'll continue. And then I just get so busy that it just never happens. So if I happen to be working in an area that there's a rarity, I'll try to go see if I can chase it. But I don't get that opportunity very often. There is a the Rio Grande Valley Birding Festival. Usually happens every November. I was lucky enough to be asked to be a guide for that festival last November, and so doing that, I was able to actually spend some time birding in the valley, which is something that I don't get to do very often. Usually, my birding in the valley, quote unquote, is I'm doing Harris's hawk behavioral observations, and I'm looking at the birds while they fly by as I'm watching the hawks.
So no cattle tyrant.
I did go see the cattle tyrant,
Oh,
actually.
okay.
So the reason why is because I had stopped in Corpus on my way to my study area. So it was before I actually started. And I took a little detour and I did go see that silly guy. He was sitting on
That is him. Yep, that describes him to a
the
T.
Brooke, I like the way you describe birds, 'cause like he was just a little silly guy out there being lost.
He was a silly lost little guy.
Yeah. So I actually
Confused.
guided at the festival last year too. I'm surprised we didn't run into each other.
Oh, really? You know, I think I remember seeing you.
Maybe. Should have came
Maybe.
up and been like, let me tell you about Harris's hogs.
Yeah, just talk to everyone about Harris's hogs, even if they don't ask. Just hand out
Just
some
random people on
pamphlets.
the street, like, have you heard about the Harris's hogs?
They are my special interests, so I like when people in real life ask me about my research. I'm like, oh, great, I get to hold you hostage now.
I'm picturing them being like, can you tell me what that hawk is over there? And then it's a Harris, and you just turn with a smile and you're like, you're gonna be here for 60 minutes, my friend.
The locals in the valley, when I go into gas stations and whatnot while I'm working, you know, they'll kind of ask me what my binoculars and stuff are about. And usually I tell them I'm studying the hawks. They're like, oh yes, the brown eagles that are outside.
Yep.
They are so cool. I'm like, oh yeah, Harris's hawks. And then I have to kind of stop myself from info dumping on them. But sometimes people like it. I like to volunteer at the bird banding station down there while I'm working on my days off, quote unquote. And there's a lot of locals that I encounter there, and they like to hear about the research. But yeah, and it's normal day-to-day people, if I'm meeting new friends or whatever, and they make the mistake of asking me, I'm like, oh, okay, you're in for a talk now.
You
Think
never
you
know how much to. Oh, sorry, Derek, go ahead.
I was gonna say, I think you need a little pamphlet, so you can just be like, just take this, just read this later, and it just has all the info in it.
I was gonna say, you never know how much info to impart on somebody when they ask because they'll just say, what's that bird over there? And then you don't know how much about birds they know. And then when all of a sudden they're like, it struck me as more of a second cycle gull, you're like, okay, we can talk now.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, exactly. I'm not that knowledgeable to where I can see stuff like that. So when someone's, you know, when there's a birder and they're saying something about second cycle goals, I'm just like, oh, you are smarter than me. I gotta go.
But second cycle Harris's Hawks seem to be
So
the
I can talk
advantage.
about second cycle versus
Were your
Hawks.
tours just like, oh, stopping every 5 minutes, like, hey, there's another Harris's Hawk. Look at what this one's doing. Then, like, a mile down, another Harris's Hawk.
So we actually did a Harris's Hawk tour
There you go.
on the trip. So people, there was about, I think there were four or five very lovely individuals, and it was myself and Andrea Gibbons, who is the previous graduate student on my project, and we led the tour, and we just drove them around to all of our study areas, and just like, there's this guy, and we got to tell them all about the birds, and oh, there's this guy, you want to hear her life story? And that was really, really fun. And then, of course, on the other tours that I guided, when people did ask me about them, I was very happy to talk about them.
Were you one of those people that grew up watching nature documentaries?
No, I
Okay.
wasn't. So
So, oh, go
actually,
ahead.
I was just gonna say I say this all the time. I didn't grow up interested in nature at all. Birding got me in. Birds got me into nature. And now, you know, I'm outside every day. I love it.
So, I was going to say, when you watch nature documentaries at any point in your adolescence, some of the animals and the places almost become like celebrities to you. So, you see the Galapagos Island turtles on stuff. And then if you see them in real life, not that we've seen those yet, but you're like, wow, that's something I'm
You
super
picked a
familiar with.
very like example we
That
have
was like the
not.
first thing that came to my
I was
mind
thinking
was
of
Galapagos
saguaro,
Island.
seeing saguaro in
No, not
documentaries and
saguaro,
then going to
Galapagos Island
saguaro. All right,
tortoises.
fine. He's lost. Go ahead.
But there was this Sonoran Desert documentary that we used to watch on VHS. And I remember a scene with the Harris's Hawks, and they were cooperatively hunting, and it was a big deal in the thing. So when we went down to the Rio Grande Valley and saw the Harris's Hawks, it was like seeing a celebrity. Even though they're not that rare down there, there was a moment where you just are like, wow, I know that thing already.
That's really cool. I think Dr. Bednar's helped produce that documentary.
Dude, that'd be cool if he helped produce that. That'd be neat.
I believe that he said that he did one in the Sonoran Desert, and it's, you know, now it's like a just like a VHS tape, VHF tape. But and he said he would show it to me one day. But yeah, no, for sure. I think that I do that all the time, especially with birds, you know. A lot of people don't get excited about bald eagles, but that was really one of the only birds I knew growing up. So, you know, I see bald eagles and I geek out.
I don't know. I feel like I always encounter people that geek out over bald eagles. That's like one of our running jokes is that you'll be looking at a rarity and somebody who's a non-birder will roll down the window and say, "Did you see that eagle? Are you looking at the eagles?"
No, I'm looking at this blue bunting over here.
That hurts because we don't have blue bunting yet. So,
Yeah, that's true. So,
That's
Brooke,
true.
you talk a lot about, your mentor, and I feel like those people are really gems. Like, without kind of those people to spark interest, we wouldn't get like you would probably wouldn't have had your interest in raptors without your mentor. Can you tell a little bit about how important those people are to like just getting more people into research and being passionate and finding their passion?
So I had three mentors, I guess, and three really, really influential mentors. And two of them were in my undergrad. So Dr. Bednar's, I call him, it's funny you called him a gem because his name is Jim. So I call him Jim. And Kelsey Biles, who was the original American kestrel researcher at UNT. And so those two people were just so bird crazy. And they had this passion in their voice and in their eyes when they talked about birds and when they got really excited about what they were doing and they loved, you know, kind of info dumping, quote unquote, sharing all this information, and I loved it. I remember, so before I ever volunteered at the bird banding station, I was Kelsey Biles's student, and she there was an ecology lab, and there was a bird lecture, and so she showed us the great-tailed grackles and the American crows, like the super common birds, and she just got so excited talking about the easy birds, the birds you can drive down the road and see. And as I was driving home from class that day, never really thought about birds before. I was looking at the crows and I was getting all excited. I was like, oh my gosh, Kelsey, I saw a crow the other day. And she's like, that's amazing, Brooke. Without them too, there's no way I would be here right now. There's no way I would be studying birds. I would probably, you know, hopefully I would have ended up doing ecology of some sort. But no, there's no way I would be as excited about birds as I am now, because going out on those birding trips and hearing them talk about what they do, and Jim is really my biggest cheerleader as far as, you know, if I'm having a bad day, if I'm feeling down on myself and what I've accomplished, he can, you know, tell me a story about one time that he failed and what he learned from it, like a, you know, like an old grandpa, and makes me feel so much better. And so one of my personal goals in life is to be that for somebody else. And I try really hard to always talk about what I do the same way that they, you know, that Kelsey talked about what she did, especially when I'm talking to my technicians and undergraduates at the bird banding station and stuff. And my colleagues, the other graduate students, I think we all kind of do that. And so seeing people kind of converting from, you know, their interest in bugs or insects or law even, to being as obsessed with birds as we are, is really, really cool. So I think it's important. I always tell all my undergrads, all my freshmen, when I teach biology in the fall, to try to get involved with research as early as you can. And one of the biggest reasons why is because of the people that you're going to meet. And hopefully they will share with you the way that, and, you know, inspire you the way that I was inspired.
Yeah, 100%. I did a tour with Kelsey at the festival, and she definitely has that enthusiasm, you know, that infectiousness. She was also really excited because she bought a new pair of binoculars, and she was like showing them off to everyone. She's like, look at these cool bins that I got.
I was rooming with her, and so she came into my hotel room after the binoculars and was like, look at these, look at the binoculars. Yeah, she's still one of my best friends to this day.
Yeah, it was kind of funny because I was doing like an interview with Justin. Like I was, you know, interviewing him about the festival, and we were asking her about the binoculars, and they're like, well, why'd you get those? And I think it was Vortex one. She's like, it has this little thing on the bottom for your thumbs. And we were like, that's the defining factor. And like, yeah, that's what it was.
That's Kelsey.
Yeah. So what's next for you after your master's?
So I always answer this question by saying my goal is to just graduate right now. As far as what's next for me, at some point I hope to get my PhD. I hope to continue studying raptor behavior. Right now I've got a project designed to which will allow me to continue studying Harris's hawks as a PhD project, which I'm really, really, really excited about, but it's all gonna depend on funding. And, you know, if that doesn't work out, I will take a little break from school. I jumped from my bachelor's straight into my master's. And I'm hoping to do a little bit of traveling, do some seasonal field work, and meet new people and learn new skills and techniques that'll make me a more well-rounded ornithologist. Eventually, like I said, I hope to get my PhD and continue doing research at a university. That's my ultimate goal. I've also recently really gotten into geographic information systems and doing data analysis with maps. So maybe that'll turn into something too. Who knows?
Sweet. Is there, you know, a next raptor on your list that you really want to see that you haven't seen yet?
Northern goshawk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think
I haven't seen one yet.
Well, it's now American goshawk.
Oh, yes, yes. Oh,
yeah.
Pardon my French. Yes, the American goshawk.
Yeah, I think Ryan's the only one out of the three of us that have seen that one.
The only one that I've seen came down into Wisconsin in the central lower part and was trying to eat pheasants from a pheasant farm. So the picture I have of it is just it's sitting on the pheasant farm netting, just staring at the pheasants. So it wasn't the most majestic moment ever, but I still have it.
He's so real for that.
Yeah. He was not ashamed of it. I think the farmer chased him off. I think that's the only reason he wasn't there longer.
I actually got, before I accepted the Harris's Hawk Project, I also got hired to study American goshawks, at the time Northern goshawks. That's what I thought I was going to do before I got the graduate position. And so now I'm, you know, kind of trying to figure out how I can get to one as soon as possible, because that's the next raptor on my list. Working in the valley, I've seen a much better diversity of raptors than most people that live in the United States have. And I'm lucky for that, but I got to see more of the more common United States ones that don't pop into Texas very often.
How about Jeer Falcon?
I haven't seen that one either.
That's like the ultimate falcon, I feel like.
Yep, I agree. Soon.
When
Snowy
is
owl.
Oh, snowy owl. Well, you could come up here for a snowy owl in
Yeah.
wintertime. Could probably get snowy owl and probably not Jeer Falcon anymore. They used to have Jeer Falcon as something you could find, but now they repress it on eBird or suppress it on eBird rather. So it's a lot harder.
Yeah.
You got anything else, Derek?
I think that's pretty much all I had. Brooke, is there anything else you wanted to share about your research? I guess one thing I wanted to know is how can people stay up to date on what you're doing? Is there like a website that you guys have or, publications people can look at or Instagram even?
Yeah,
so
Raptors.gov.
yeah, raptors.gov. We post, so myself and Brooke Prater, so there's Brooke Poplin on the Harris's Hawks and Brooke Prater on the American Kestrels. We run the UNT Raptor Research Facebook page. So that's what it is, UNT Raptor Research. And we try to update super duper often on the work that we're doing, and what we're accomplishing. And when we can't publish all of our results, but hopefully when we start getting stuff kind of solidified, we can start posting more about our results of our data collection and whatnot, and what we're actually finding. But for the most part now, it's kind of just keeping people up to date with how our efforts are going. And there are opportunities to do donor experiences with our American Kestrels. So Brooke Prater posts about that when that comes around every year. And yeah, that's kind of our only avenue right now. We also have a painted bunting project at UNT, and that one I believe is UNT Painted Bunting Project. So if you're listening to this and you really like painted buntings, that's another cool project that we do a donor experience for.
Awesome. Well, cool. Thanks so much, Brooke, for taking the time. If you guys are interested, make sure to check out the Facebook page. And thanks to everyone for watching this episode of the Badgerland Birding Podcast.